As our current health crisis continues, there are still many questions and concerns about COVID-19, especially as many people think about going back to work or school. This is Lisa Berry, and a big part of the big picture is testing. How does it work? Where are we in the process? And what's next as the seasons begin to change? We're joined now on 89.1 WEMU to answer some of those questions by Emily Toth-Martin, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Thanks for joining us here on WEMU.
Great to talk.
We hear a lot about testing. What can you tell us about that? Where are we in that process and what's necessary and where should we be going? I think that's like five questions. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a big topic and it's one that a lot of people are focused on. You know, the tests that are really, you know, we're really focused on needing capacity for and needing ramp up for are the tests for the virus, the tests that use the swabs in your nose or your throat to figure out if you've got active virus shedding in your body and could potentially be transmissible to other people. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of great work building capacity and building the ability to do these tests, both in the commercial spaces and in the private spaces. We're even seeing some kind of exciting technologies start to come to the FDA for review to make those more easily done kind of in community settings. Problem is that the need for testing is still kind of outpacing these in a way that the way we're seeing that manifest is that test turnaround time is getting longer and longer and longer.
And why
so
is
it's
that?
Easier. It's a complex situation to actually get a test done. So it's easier now to find a site to go and get the swab taken from your nose. But that swab then has to be transported to a lab that's going to process it. And as labs, particularly in areas without a lot of kind of medical lab capacity in the local area, are going to need to transport these swabs sometimes across the country to get those processed and then have that whole process happen over there and then have the results, you know, communicated back over to the local area where the test was taken. So it causes a big delay in getting your results back.
I'm hearing some people say that they went and had the test and they aren't getting their results back at all. Is that something you're hearing about or this should be followed up on?
You know, anecdotally, I've heard a couple of cases of that. It definitely is something that, you know, people should continue to talk to either the testing site or their medical provider to try to get that. But then again, that's another symptom of a fact that, you know, tests just aren't about number of swabs and the number of chemical reactions that you can afford, but it's also about this infrastructure and this system for keeping track of things and communicating results back. And we're kind of building this system on the fly in the U.S. largely. And so, you know, that's sort of a symptom of the fact that we're trying to get this infrastructure built up so quickly.
What can you tell us about? Is it the Quest test? Isn't the University of Michigan suggesting that to incoming students?
So the test that's being used at the University of Michigan for students coming into university housing is the same as the test that you're going to get at a lot of, it's the same technology that you'll get if you go to a drive-up site or to your clinical care provider. And I think that, you know, as a commercial lab, they're able to kind of scale and work with students that are not in Ann Arbor yet and are kind of living all over the country. And so so the infrastructure makes that very useful, but the technology of the test is going to be very similar to what you'd get at your doctor's office.
What about at-home testing for COVID-19? Where are we on that?
I'd love to see at-home testing for COVID-19. You know, this is something where the FDA is not very close on, but I know that actively reviewing and moving some of these technologies forward. What we could expect to see before we see true at-home testing, which is like, I think of a pregnancy test as the classic
right,
at-home test.
Yeah.
You buy it, you take it in the privacy of your home, and then you decide what you're going to do with the answer based on your own situation. And for the COVID test, you know, what we probably could see, some of these technologies will be rolled out like in community sites and in doctor's offices and clinics where you can go and you can take the test right there and wait for your answer right there. And we see that step first before we see it actually be sent to people's homes.
How long of a process is it in reality to develop an at-home test for COVID-19?
You know, it's It's hard to say because this is actually, you know, an at-home test for a respiratory virus is not something that has ever been approved before. And so they're kind of making up the playbook as they're doing the approvals. And so there's a bit of uncertainty in trying to figure out what that time frame for validation is before, because I actually am not aware of any companies that have made it along that process yet. So it's a little bit of a mystery.
Your area of expertise is respiratory epidemiology, correct?
That's right. Yep.
What insights can you share with us then about COVID-19 that maybe we haven't heard about so far?
Well, you know, so I've for a long time focused on respiratory viruses, how they impact us, and what kind of diseases we have that manifest after you get infected with a respiratory virus. And I think one of the things that I'm very interested in that has started to kind of appear in the news media, but I think has gotten less attention to date, is that, you know, we've known for a while that it's sort of this understudied area, what happens after you've had that acute illness with a respiratory virus. And so, you know, and I think everybody may have know anecdotal stories of people they may know have gotten an influenza infection and don't recover right away. You may recover well enough to maybe go back to work or to feel better, but you have this persistent respiratory illness, maybe a cough, maybe fatigue that takes a while to resolve. I think, you know, we're starting to see evidence that that's happening with COVID too. And so I think, you know, we need to get on top of understanding that very quickly, because with this many people getting infected, the burden is not just the number of people getting infected, but how long are they infected for? And what is that cumulative burden on our population that we're building up, that people are carrying around, sort of long-term, you know, shortness of breath or fatigue that they're battling?
As a University of Michigan epidemiologist, are you concerned that people are letting their guard down?
I think so. And I think, you know, I think we see stories in the news about that, but I also, you know, we see stories in the data about that too. You know, you can see data that shows that people are out and moving around more than they were at the beginning of this, and certainly almost to levels even before the epidemic started. And what concerns me most about this is I think that the fall and the winter are going to be challenging, because we're not just going to have COVID to contend with, but we're going to have all these other viruses that cause the similar types of symptoms and cause kind of cold and flu season symptoms. And as a community, we're not used to walking into the grocery store anymore and having people cough and sneeze, right? We're used to, you stay home when you're symptomatic. And I think that's going to become a bigger task to contend with once we have other viruses and other kind of cold and flu symptoms filtering around.
In your view, what is the best case scenario to end this? I talk to all the experts like you and I say, when is it going to be over? Do you have any vision for that?
You know, I'd love to see a vaccine, and I am thrilled to see the progress in the vaccine landscape, but I also have worked in flu vaccine and other spaces for long enough to know that we got to wait to see the data to see how well these are going to work. But the other thing that I'm watching is the antiviral space. I mean, if we can get a quick acting, easily to administer antiviral into the market, I think that's another way that this can end smoothly and swiftly if we get fast treatment to people. And so, you know, I'm hopeful that we can see something like that happen in the next 6 months or so. I'm optimistic. But again, we have to wait to see what the development space continues to look like.
Just to clarify, an antiviral spray, or what did you say, vaccine?
An antiviral medication.
Medication.
So treatment.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
So if people start to show symptoms and we can get them treated fast and have them not be infectious to others, I mean, that would be really exciting. I know there's a lot of work going into that. I don't know, you know, how close any of these products are to being approved yet or to be even in trials, but I'd like to see that development space continue to grow, because it's not just about prevention. It's also about how fast can we treat people and get them back to work, get them back to school, but also have them be able to be in the community and not be infectious anymore.
But that is something that's in the works.
There are a lot of companies working really hard on trying to get these products together. So
it doesn't seem like we've heard that much about that.
We don't hear as much about that because, you know, vaccines is really, what you want to do is prevent the infection from happening in the first place,
right?
As public health, that's sort of our number one priority. But even, you know, we could even see positive movement in controlling this by better treatments.
So here you are. You are an associate professor of epidemiology at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. I like to follow you experts around. So how are you? Are you out? Are you going out to eat? Do you? I mean, what's the protocol we should still be following?
You know, my family is still pretty. We are still pretty bubbled. So we don't go out a lot. There is one outdoor cafe that's sort of our family regular location that I may occasionally have something outside there, but we don't do any indoor dining or anything like that right now. You know, we're lucky to be able to live our life pretty remotely. And I'm just a big fan of grocery delivery just because I like groceries. I don't like going to the grocery store even in non-pandemic times. So, we are pretty still protected in my family.
That's Emily Toth Martin, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Thanks so much for sharing your information with us here on 89.1 WEMU.
Great. Happy to do it.